taking a flat piece, shape parallelogram. And identifying basically this side, and this side with this side. And the lengths of these things are just given by basically the length of this blackboard. So it's a flat piece of geometry, but you get something which looks like a 2D from outside curved geometry, but you should not be fooled by that. So you get this source, which is locally flat, and you can, of course, construct several tori. And the point is, you get, they have different geometries. It can differ by their geometries. And this is parameterized by this point, which is called the modulo parameter, tau. It's usually put into some complex coordinates. And this tau defines you basically the length of the two geodesics which you have around the non-contractible loops. So if you imagine a torus, basically a donut, and put a loop around the hole, you cannot contract it to the identity, and the length is basically parameterized by these numbers. And the phase space turns out, so the phase space, which is it's a physical phase space, which is in one-to-one correspondence to the solution, turns out to be given by this parameter tau and a conjugated variable. And tau is given by two real numbers, so you get a four-dimensional phase space. So I'm not going to construct these solutions. If you want to read about these solutions, they're explained in this book. But this will not be so much important at the moment for understanding all these formalisms which you need to construct our quantum geometry framework. Okay, so here you have finitely many solutions. But you started actually with a field theory. That's the point of a topological field theory. So the next topic, as I told you here, one of these questions was a question, what kind of geometries you sum over? And I told you that you usually start with a metric, and you assume that this metric is non-degenerate. And one of the hard points is actually to put into the requirement, to put into the quantum theory the requirement that it should be non-degenerate. And another question is, should you do that at all? Instead of a metric, you can introduce triads, tetrads, or orthonormal frames, or n-binds. All mean the same, except that triads refers to three. So that is more for three dimensions, and tetrad for four dimensions. And as the name suggests, orthonormal frame. These are things which define you an orthonormal frame at every point in your space-time. And we will need that in order to phrase our gravity in a language of gauge theory, which is similar to Young-Mills. And that will be very important for quantization. So to do that, you know, we introduce really an orthonormal frame at every point in our space-time. So that means in three dimensions, you have three vectors, which we call E, mu, 1 to 3. And also normal would mean that if you take the inner product with these vectors, in our case, you require that this gives the Euclidean metric. You know, for Minkowski signature, you would require that it gives you the Minkowski metric. And this we can also write as E mu g with a j with a index mu pulled down. And this is to be required to be, if you pull this up, this is required to be delta ijk. So what you see already here is that this is the inverse of E mu j with respect to the mu index. Okay, so now we have basically this frame at every point. And the thing is that you can actually reconstruct your metric with help of these tetrads or triads. And in this case, as you can see, you will just need these inverses. So E mu j has now the index down, so it's a covector. Actually a one form, but with an internal index. So if you take this equation here and apply EG mu, we consider basically this combination. If you take this and contract again with these tetrads from the left and to the right, you will see that this is given by, sum by delta jk, that this has to be given by the space-time metric. So contract this with these things, and you go back to this one. So instead of, so our plan is, instead of taking this as our basic variables, we take the triads as, or the co-triads as basic variables. Yes? Uh-huh. Ah, sorry. This point. Thanks. So we replace G menu as basic variables by this co-triads, emu. And now we have, before, basically, our basic variables were given as the space of all positive definite symmetric matrices, G mu nu. Now we could claim, okay, we take all possible fields, all possible matrices, E, I, mu. I didn't told you anything about the symmetry. Of course, if you take an arbitrary field of this form, you will not necessarily get a positive definite matrix. So actually, we change our space slightly. One is that we have an additional index. Another is that, in principle, you would have to demand positive definiteness. And this is not done in some approaches, as we will see. So this is a hint that you might expect in these cases, if you do quantization and start from these subtle differences, you might get completely different quantum theories, actually. So now we have this internal metric. And you can count components. And as I told you, this can be basically, doesn't need to be symmetric in any sense. This is a symmetric matrix. So you will find you have now more components in your basic variables than this. But indeed, what we have introduced is a further gauge equivalent, because rotating this frame by an orthogonal rotation, you will find that it leaves this equation invariant, which means that it defines the same metric here. So as you can check, if you basically change your trials, aj prime mu, or these are the cotrials, by, let me check what my convention is, rjk, ek mu, where this is a rotation matrix, then you plug that in into the equation, and you get this expression for basically delta Gm of, for the contraction of the new transformed cotriets. And any idea what this is? If you contract two rotation matrices in this index and this index, it's a delta. Somewhere I suppose a very faint delta, that's correct. Delta KL, because as you might remember, for rotation matrices, the transpose of a rotation matrix is given by the inverse. So we get the same metric as before. So this introduces an SO3 gauge symmetry in the sense that choosing different frames, which are just related by rotation, gives us the same metric. It gives us the same Riemannian geometry. Okay. And so now you already know what an orthonormal frame is. Are there any questions for this? Because we have one point now to cover, which is we introduce this internal index, J, and as you might have learned in general relativity, you know, you introduce the connection to be able to transport, parallel transport vectors around a curve or along a curve, because that was basically in general non-trivial. And now we have an additional index. So to know how we transport these objects, we need again to introduce a notion of parallel transport. Which again is defined by a so-called covariant derivative. And this is defined via the spin connection, which is spin refers really to the internal index. And as you remember, spins come up in the representation of actually the covering group of SO3. So that's why it's called spin connection. And basically, we define this covariant derivative in the same way as you might remember the Christoffel symbols were or the covariant derivatives for just normal space-time vectors were defined. So if you have an internal index, it's a plus. We add to the partial derivative this connection coefficient. Multiplied with this scalar with internal index. So this is for scalars. So such scalars you, for instance, get by taking your cotetrad and contracting this a vector. And if you have basically say another covector, a spacetime covector, and you want to compute the covariant derivative of that, you have to take care of both indices. So this you take basically the Christoffel symbols. Which take care of this index, and then you take again these things. Now, if you remember, or not, this covariant derivative and now basically the usual spacetime covariant derivative, which was this plus minus gamma coefficient, depending on what it acts on. To be really the Levi-Civita connection, you were requiring that this covariant derivative annihilates the metric. And that was also very convenient to do because that allowed you to pull down and raise indices even inside these covariant derivatives. And we do something similarly. So we have to find an equation for these coefficients for the spin connection, and we do that by requiring that the covariant derivatives of our co-triads vanishes, and if you apply this definition, you find that omega mu jk is just given as the Levi-Civita derivative applied to cotriad and contracted with an inverse or the triad, the original triad here. Okay, so what we furthermore want to actually have is that we have, you know, some consistency conditions with respect to taking contractions inside the derivative of the J index. And this is actually ensured. It will turn out that these spin connections have to be antisymmetric in these indices. So I told you that you know, since we have these this internal matrix, which is just given by the Kronecker delta, we can be fairly liberal with the position of our internal indices. And indeed, it turns out that, you know, it doesn't really matter. It's the same formula if I have objects where I put the index down. So I can define these coefficients with two indices down, and it will turn out that these have to be antisymmetric in these two indices. And as we will see, this actually reflects the metricity connection, the metricity condition for the connection. So if you take this equation, you know, you get actually delta kj by definition. And this assumes that basically here you use the Levi-Civita condition because you can put this outside. And if you apply this definition, you will find that this is given by the anti-symmetrization, or this is given by these two indices, which means that omega jk has to be minus omega kj. And this is equivalent to requiring that our connection, that this connection vanishes. So one condition for the Levi-Civita connection is this one. Do you remember another condition? Torsion free. Indeed. And do you remember what torsion free means? Means. Yeah, it's basically in this, probably meant it. If you take the commutator of covariant derivatives, apply that to scalars, that gives you zero. So here we have actually the spin connection, which automatically implements metricity. And for the Levi-Civita connection, it's a bit different because here torsion freeness is automatically implemented if you have symmetry in these two indices. But what we still need to require, basically, is the torsion freeness. And you get automatically a torsion-free condition connection if you use this equation. But it turns out, I mean, this gives you automatically basically metricity and torsion freeness. But you can basically get rid of the part which tells you that it's metric, so you are left only with torsion freeness if you take the anti-symmetrization of this condition. And the reason is if you take this thing, and write it out, you will see we will get just the anti-symmetric combination of the Levi-Civita symbols. Cool. So let's consider this thing. So that is given by the partial derivatives. Then I have, you know, to take care of the space-time indices. And then I have my internal indices. Okay. And so this vanishes if the Levi-Civita connection is torsion free. Which means if you want to get, in the end, a torsion-free connection for also your space-time indices, if you just work with the spin connection, you have to require that this is zero. And I hope I'm going to define the right thing with the right factor. So this equation, the right-hand side, defines the so-called torsion tensor. And you have to keep in mind that it is a kind of anti-symmetrized derivative of our co-triads. I broke the thing. Okay. So this is a torsion tensor. The goal is to express everything in the end, just with triads and not with the Levi-Civita connection. So we have to replace the Levi-Civita connection with something else. And in the next step, we will actually introduce the spin connection at some point as independent variable. So it's all also necessary to basically formulate our theory as a gauge theory. And for that, we need all these internal indices, yes?
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
To this one?
Yeah.
That is, oh, sorry, that is a. That is a T that defines the torsion tensor. And this has to vanish if I want to have a spin connection which is torsion free. Yeah, yeah. So this anti-symmetry means, yeah, you pick an orthonormal normal basis, but automatically it also implies metricity. So to maybe, you know, to make a further point, we will go to first order theory, description of our theory. And in this theory, the connection and the triads will be independent variables. So I introduce these concepts, you know, defining the connection via the triads. But there's a so-called, usually for standard gravity, there's a first order formulation where you basically take the matrix and an arbitrary connection. So an arbitrary connection means, you know, for the matrix, for instance, you would take still a symmetric connection, so it would be still torsion free, but it doesn't need to be metric. And here we do something similar. We take the triads and we take the spin connection as our independent variables. And we will still require that it is kind of anti-symmetric in our indices, which somehow you know, will implement metricity. But we do not necessarily require a priori that it is torsion free. And actually, we will get this torsion freeness as an equation of motion if we do that. So that's why I define this torsion tensor, because we will see that we will get an equation of motion which requires this torsion tensor to vanish. and you know, I also wrote you this formula for the spin connection. So this spin connection, if you apply this formula, it automatically implies that the torsion is vanishing. But actually, you can get the spin connection by just requiring that this vanishes. So this, you know, is actually a weaker equation, but you can calculate the spin connection from that condition and from the and from knowing that the spin connection is anti-symmetric. And that is an exercise, yeah? No, in this equation, too, that was the motivation. That was the motivation to tell the rest of this. So, if you want, so this, you know, so this I derive by taking this formula from the spin connection. So, this basically formula tells you, okay, you can always define the spin connection if you have the Christoffel symbols. Then this is non-zero, and that is why I defined the torsion tensor. So the torsion tensor is zero if the Christoffel symbols are torsion-free, then the torsion tensor is zero here. But if they are not symmetric, then you get a non-vanishing torsion thing, because this has to be zero. OK. yeah, I guess we've managed it. So we have torsion, and then there's another important thing which we need to express, which comes with a connection. Curvature. So we need to express curvature. And you know, curvature appears in the definition of our Einstein-Hilbert action, and at some point we have to reformulate the Einstein-Hilbert action as in these variables. So if you remember how curvature was defined, curvature had something to do with the non-commutativity of the covariant derivative. And here I told you for torsion freeness means it vanishes on scalars. Of course, it doesn't vanish on vectors. So if you parallel transport a vector around a parallelogram, you find something non-zero. And that is exactly given by the Riemann curvature tensor. And I use a definition of all kinds of conventions which come here in. You know, they are fixed by this Bessel condition. The Riemann curvature tensor is defined as this commutator of the covariant derivatives applied to covector. Now this covector, yeah. Are we the No, so we have two objects, we have two connections now around and two matrix. Now there's still the space-time matrix, which is G mu nu, and then there's the internal matrix, which is delta JK. So this, you know, this nabla, this is a covariant derivative with respect to G mu nu. And this capital D means that you have to take also into account all J indices. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so now we have both the Christoffel symbols, which are defined by this equation that they should annihilate the metric. So you know you can have all objects around the Christoffel symbols and the spin connection and you know, nabla and this capital D. And the Christoffel symbols at this point are still defined by this equation above, because now I have to express this Riemann curvature in terms of my spin connection. And the Riemann curvature, you know, is defined if you have a Christoffel symbol, which is defined through this metric connection. Yeah. So say that, so, you know, we now, so for this calculation, we assume that the omegas are given by this equation. By this equation of, you know, covariant derivative of the triads. And still the nabla applied to our space-time metric vanishes. And the space-time metric itself is non-trivial. But we have this internal metric, which of course is trivial. Okay? So now basically we, and for this calculation, because we have to require, we have to make the connection between the Riemann curvature and what I will define to be the curvature of the spin connection, we have to assume that we have all these objects around. And okay, of course I can define also d mu on anything which has just spacetime indices, and this is similar to what happens if you apply the Levi-Civita connection or the covariant derivative, the spacetime covariant derivative, to anything which doesn't have a spacetime metric, nothing happens. So in this case, if you don't have any internal metric, it actually is equal to the spacetime covariant derivative here. That means since we don't really have any internal index here, you know, we can take this thing because it's equal on objects without an index. I can replace basically this spacetime covariant derivative with this spin connection covariant derivative. And having done this, I look at my defining equation for the spin connection, which was that the spin connection, which is this left one here. That means, you know, I can pull out the spin coefficients and get this equation. And later note that this is again some anti-symmetrized derivative. I just managed, so you know, all the important equations will be just expressed by anti-symmetrized derivatives, and that is a sign that we can actually express everything in so-called differential forms, which I will manage at some point later. So if you go through the definition, so now apply just the definition of the covariant derivative. If you're worried that this index is now down, it actually happens. As I told you, it doesn't really matter. We get basically the same definition. As before, oh. Let me check KJ now. With a plus sign, and note that you know because of the antisymmetry, that is consistent with the contraction rule. That if I contract two indices, I get basically a trivial term here. So we take just this definition and write that out. And after some calculation, you will find this expression. What happens is, you know, you express everything by this formula or the slightly generalized formula if you have one, no, that, yeah, if you have a spacetime index, and you get the commutator of partial derivatives, which is of course zero. So all just all the partial derivatives of just v vanish. But if you apply it once, you get partial derivatives of the spin connection, which are these two terms. And you have two times the covariant derivatives, so you get an antisymmetric combination of two times the spin connection appearing. So that's what you get. And from that, you can basically read off your R mu nu rho sigma, because it's exactly everything which is in front of V sigma. So we get a formula for our Riemann tensor, which is now expressed via the spin connection and not with Christoffel symbols. And the thing in the middle . Since this is a curvature, and here we just have, you know, basic coefficients, so this is just you change from one basis to another basis. This is defined to be the curvature of the spin connection. F mu nu jk. So you will find it more with indices up, but for that you just have to basically pull just all the indices up. Okay. So what we have, to summarize, you know, with this orthonormal frame, you get a torsion tensor and you get this curvature tensor. So I think we still manage, you know, I just tell you the result because it's more or less a not very interesting calculation. Of expressing the Einstein-Hilbert action in terms of F and the triad. But for that, we first do one thing. We say that omega mu jk is antisymmetric in j and k. And if you look at this equation, you will find that also F mu nu jk is antisymmetric in j and k. And if you know we are, if you are in 3D, you can save one index by basically always summarizing two indices, two antisymmetric indices into one index by using the Levi-Civita symbol. So we define this. We define mu omega, you know, new coefficients mu L omega by this equation. And this is the same equation. So this just saves a bit on our indices. And you can now express everything again. And these tensors, which are now basically the curvature tensor and this torsion tensor, So these, you know, instead of just getting plus minus here and these two anti, you know, these two antisymmetric combinations, they are now summarized in this actually structure constant. Which some of you might know are the structure constants of the SO3 Lie algebra or SU2 Lie algebra. And here we get So these are, you know, these are all straightforward calculations. You just have to plug these formulas into the definition of F and T, and maybe sometimes use an epsilon identity. And here you can basically already see a sign that we are going to gauge theory, if you have seen that before. If not, don't be worried. But this will be, it's a formula for the for even a Young-Mills connection with an SU2 structure group. Okay, and it's a straightforward exercise. You know, take all these formulas together and express the Riemann, the Ricci scalar in terms of the triads and the curvature. And as an exercise in either calculating or reading, you can check that this is given by this object, which I define in a minute. So the Ricci scalar is again given by, you know, some contraction of our curvature tensor. And this is again just the Levi-Civita, so-called Levi-Civita symbol, which is different from the Levi-Civita tensor. And I use this tilde to tell you, you are not allowed, you're not supposed to pull down or pull up indices, except you, you know, introduce a much more complicated, slightly more complicated notation. So this is really defined to be one for this one and otherwise to be totally antisymmetric. And as you will learn or figure out yourself, this is not a tensor, but a tensor density. And you will see if you pull down all the indices, you know, you get another object. Which you might call E tilde, but in my lecture notes, I will call E tilde again. This is also the Levi-Civita tensor. And in my notation, this is different from so you have to be careful with these objects, and that's why I use just a tilde on top of these. And sometimes these tildes are, you know, denote densities which are slightly different from just tensors. So it just means, you know, keep these indices up or down, but don't recent the pull them here, because if you remember the determinant formula, that is not the same. Okay, and just let me tell you, this is the determinant of the co-triads, and the determinant of the co-triads, I mean, the co-triads were something like the square root of the metric. So we had G mu nu. It's basically the contraction of these two things. So that means that this determinant is basically given by the square root of G minus 1, because we have here the inverse to these things. I write this. Yeah. So if you take the square root of G, this determinant vanishes, cancels, and we are left with the final result of this lecture. Which is the 3V action in terms of triads and the curvature. And next time, we will consider this action and actually understand it as a first order action. And we will see that, you know, things become very, very much easier than in the Riemann, in the further Einstein-Hilbert action. So the trick, we could understand this as a function of the triads only, meaning that we solve for the spin connection in terms of the triads. But the trick here is to understand this function as a, you know, this action as a function of the triads and an independent spin connection. And you know, you already see that if you vary this with respect to the triads, you just get that this curvature tensor is zero. And as I will tell you tomorrow, if you vary this with respect to the spin connection, we get actually the torsion freeness condition, which exactly allows you to solve for the spin connection for the triads, or as derivatives of triads. but the advantage of this connection, of this expression, is that it's just, if you take these omega as independent variables, it's only linear in the basic variables, which is in these triad variables. And that gives us a very simple action, and also a very straightforward way of quantizing that. I mean, straightforward, if you know what to do, of quantizing this action in the path integral, for instance. OK. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. So this is because you want to have a basis. So for three-dimensional space, you have three basis vectors. Yeah. So you have actually nine. So instead of six components of your symmetric 3x3 matrix, you have nine components, which is more. But we will see that these three additional components, they correspond to the gauge freedom which we have in rotating the internal index. And if you remember, the three-dimensional rotation group is three-dimensional, which is a very special property of three dimensions. Okay. Is there more questions? Then let's meet tomorrow. And tomorrow we see that this action is very beautiful and easy to deal with.